This is Jim Eakster. Coming today on the program, we will talk with Gus Weil, the well-known political consultant. Several weeks ago on this show, he predicted the president would be reelected and that Democrats would retain control of the U.S. Senate and Republicans would body in control of the U.S. House. Guess what happened? Gus was right. We'll talk with him. Also, Jerrell Krauss, for 30 years, she was the art director for the New York Times. She has some fascinating stories about those times, including one of surviving 3 hours alone with Richard Milhouse Nixon, the 37th American president. And Lee Fondakowski and Reva Wortel, they are involved with a production at Swine Palace called Spill, related to the BP oil disaster. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is a number that works wherever you may be. And you may call us locally at 297-5633 or reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we are now more than a week past the presidential election. And 10 days after we voted as a people for the election of 2012, the results now show President Obama with 62,881,000 votes, and Mitt Romney also with 59,328,000 votes. So the president is now 3.5 million votes, in fact, a little more than 3.5 million votes ahead of Mitt Romney. This turned out to be, quite frankly, a rout. And the man who called it, among the few and the proud, is Gus Weil, the fabled political consultant from Louisiana. Good morning, Gus.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, Gus, you saw it coming.
Yes, I did. I thought that there would be a general revulsion against the ideology of the Tea Party and the extreme right. Not the Republican Party, but the extreme right, who had actually crippled the Republican Party, where they could do very little legislatively and thus became totally obstructionist. And I thought that there would be a revulsion against that, and I thought that the Democrats would carry the Senate happily, handily. They did. And I thought they would lose the House, and they did.
Well, one of those who's revolting against the Romney campaign is the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, who was supportive and wanted to be his running mate. Now he says Romney ran a lousy campaign. As you once said, everybody looks great in an inaugural parade. And as Jack Kennedy said, victory has 1,000 fathers and orphan, or defeat is an orphan.
I find the most interesting thing about our governor, Mr. Jindal, is that he has obvious contempt for his constituency, the people who elected him. That is, he has no press relations or next to none in the state. All of these statements that he makes, and they might be right or wrong, I don't know. Nor do I presume to know more than him. I don't. But all of these statements are made in other states to other groups. He has made none of these statements here to his own constituency, to the people who look to him for leadership. It is one of the strangest relationships that I've ever seen between any chief executive and his people.
Well, yesterday the governor sat down with Wolf Blitzer of CNN. He is spending more time with national media. And congratulations to Governor Jindal being named the president of the Republican Governors Conference at their meeting in Nevada. Here is a sampling of Governor Jindal criticizing Mitt Romney and his campaign and Romney's statements.
If you want voters to like you, the first thing you've got to do is to like them first. And it's certainly not helpful to tell voters that you think their votes were bought. That's certainly not a way to show them that you respect them, you like them.
What do you think, Gus?
Well, I think that that has nothing to do with the reality that at least I witnessed. I thought Romney was a very fine candidate, and I think that he is a very fine man. I can assure you, had Romney won, that Governor Jindal would be making none of these statements. He would be raving about the genius of the Romney campaign because he was aiming for a spot in the Romney cabinet, I believe.
That said, if Obama had lost, a lot of Democrats now who are patting him on the back and saying job well done, they would be doing the same thing Jindal's doing. That's the nature of the game, isn't it?
That is the nature of the game, but well, I don't think I've ever seen it so blatant as a governor who leaves the state to impart his wisdom in other areas and not in his own state. I'm told he has next to no press relations here for a man who is constantly giving his opinion to the national media.
Well, let's hear a little more from Governor Jindal with CNN Blitzer after he was elected chairman of the Republican Governors Association. Kevin?
We've got great ideas on school choice, on putting great teachers in the classrooms, on energy independence, lower, flatter tax code, without all the loopholes and the breaks for the wealthy and the special treatment. Let's go out there and put those out. Let's actually have an honest intellectual debate with the other side about the best course for this country. Let's stop insulting.
Sure.
All right. Now, sounds like he's running for president.
It does sound like a national agenda. Jindal, he is running, but I'm sure he will settle for vice president or a cabinet position next time should the Republicans win out. I think if they do, they will run against Hillary Clinton on the Democratic ticket.
We are old enough to remember, Gus, a state in which young men and women, but primarily young men in that time, dreamed of one day being governor. That was the pinnacle. Now these young men in Louisiana, like Bobby Jindal and David Vitter, they want to be president of the United States. They want to be leader of the free world.
I think that Senator Vitter would be better as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or some high military position.
I think that you're making reference to David Petraeus. With
that is where my reference lies.
I doubt that he would have security clearance based on his past activities.
I don't think so either. Petraeus is a great loss to the nation, incidentally, and I hope that he will find some other use for his talents and intellect in the United States, because he's obviously a really brilliant man. Did he make a fool of himself? Yes. He's not the first. He won't be the last. Now, you understand I'm against all those things now that I'm an old man.
Yeah, well, is there really any difference, though, between what Petraeus did and what Senator Vitter did?
No, they both got caught.
You're right. Here's an interesting statistic, Gus, as we rail against big government in red states like Louisiana. Louisiana gets $1.45 in federal taxes for every dollar it pays in taxes. This is from investorvillage.com. Alabama, for example, $1.71 for every dollar it puts in. In most of these blue states, like New York, 79 cents on its tax dollar, Colorado, 79 cents, Michigan, 85 cents. They are givers and we are takers. And why are we so different in our elective patterns right now?
You know, it's a historic question. And I read the best answer in The Advocate recently. Who was that professor who spoke to the press club, professor in political science? I don't think he was from LSU. I think he might have been from Southwestern.
From UL Lafayette.
Yes. He said that Louisiana, that was the most interesting analysis I've ever read. Now, this is his. He said, we are indeed a two-party state, but it is not black Republicans and Democrats. It is blacks and whites. That is what is going on in Louisiana. And further, he predicted that in the next few years, states like Georgia and Florida, because of their increased Latino and black populations, and even Texas, he said, he thinks will swing back into the Democrat column, whereas Louisiana will always be, at least for the foreseeable future, Republican. And I thought that was brilliant.
And I think Pearson Cross may be onto something if the parties don't change with the times. And my guess is that if Republicans start losing national elections, as they've lost the popular vote in the last five of the last six presidential elections, soon we're going to see candidates for president nominated by the Republicans who are a lot more like Gerald Ford and a lot less like Ronald Reagan.
I hope so.
Well, I think that's what will happen, and if that happens, somebody like Ford could get elected. Gerald Ford probably would have beaten Barack Obama last week.
He would have given him a heck of a race. But Romney wasn't a far-right extremist.
But he campaigned that way, though.
He had to move over to satisfy the nuts in his party, that is, that fringe who took over the party. Bonner, who's a bright, very practical man, the majority leader in the House of Representatives, you can tell that he doesn't want this nation to economically go over the cliff, but he had such a hard right constituency in the House that he bowed to them and did what they wanted. I don't know. You know those far right, those fringe groups, and the Democrats have had them too. For example, the first one that I was aware of was the States' Rights Party. Strom Thurmond, Eastland, all of those icons of the South, and they were a fringe. And then came the John Birch, but they were in the Democratic Party. Then came the John Birch Party, which became very powerful for a little while. And then the Tea Party. The good thing about fringes is that they vanish in time. I'm hopeful that's what will happen now.
Well, Bobby Jindal, who is 41 years old and has a chance to adjust. Mind you, when Ronald Reagan was 41 years old, he was still a Democrat. Bobby Jindal looks like he is going to take a moderate road as a presidential aspirant, a more moderate role. Could we be looking at the 45th American president who is now living in the mansion in Baton Rouge, Gus Weill?
Well, unless he changes his ways as a leader, I hope not. If he's a very bright man, don't get me wrong. I don't dare say any different. But unless he changes his ways, and he might do it bowing to the reality that he's just seen in this election, but those statements he just made about the Republican Party, do you think he would have made them 2 weeks ago?
No.
No.
No, but as I said, in 1948, Ronald Reagan was endorsing Harry Truman and Hubert Humphrey and was a liberal Democrat, and lo and behold, 18 years later, he runs for governor of California as a staunch conservative, and he wins, and then 14 years after that, he runs for president as the right-winger that he was.
He was what John McKithen called the practical-minded man. And the art of practicality is the art of survival in politics.
Well, and he also read his horoscope, and his schedule was made out each day based on his zodiac. That's something that maybe other candidates today should look at, Gus Weill.
I strongly recommend.
I thought you would. But he did that and wrote about it in 1966 in his autobiography, Where's the Rest of Me? And you know that was not used against him in 1980 when he ran against Jimmy Carter?
No. Isn't that interesting?
Well, opposition research is much more complex and intricate today than it was then.
Well, opposition now goes for the jugular. It's not looking for something tactile or surface. It's going for affairs, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, sadly, they're out there.
297-5633 is your number. We will go to the phone lines with Gus Weill, the well-known political consultant who's managed campaigns in Louisiana and nationally since 1958. He's now back in suburban Baton Rouge. And to show you how long Gus has been at the game, he was involved in the 1960 campaign in which John Kennedy beat Richard Nixon. We'll talk with him and with you when we return after this 1 minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Gus Weil is our guest. Mark downtown. Mark, you're on the air with Gus.
Hey, Gus. Jim, thanks for taking my call. I just wonder, Gus, if you could comment on, wouldn't it be the fact that the defeat of Romney and the Tea Party right wing that he was representing in this election by 3 million votes kind of frees up Boehner and the other Republicans in Congress to approach the president more and to stop being so obstructionist and so hardline in their positions?
Well, the Republican Party is going to have to do some bending if they want to survive as a powerful political party. And I'm sure it's the wiser heads in the party will do that.
Susan in South Downs. Hi, Susan. You're on the air with Gus Weil.
Hi. I couldn't help noticing when Bobby Jindal said that the Republicans needed to be interested in 100% of the votes rather than just 53% of the votes, that he couldn't spoke more true, that he's only interested in the votes and not in the people.
Well, it is about getting elected. No matter what your altruistic endeavors are, you got to win first, and Bobby Jindal knows how to win. And I'd give him a pass on that one, Gus.
Yes, I agree with you.
Okay. 297-5633 is your number. Charles in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Charles. You're on with Gus Weil.
Thank you. Yeah, it's ludicrous to me that Bobby Jindal would talk to us about respecting the voters when he shows absolutely no respect for those of us in Louisiana. And I wanted to get your comments about all this attention paid to the presidential election and so forth. To me, Congress is the problem. They're all sucking out of the same trough. And until we change the benefits that they get for the poor job they do, I don't think there's going to be any change.
Okay, Gus, would you respond to Charles?
Jim?
He says Congress is the real problem.
Well, Congress is going to always be a problem. When you've got that many people and you've got every kind of a nut, every kind of a philosophy, and all of them in one, it's like a gumbo with too many elements.
877-217-5757, Inkstershow@WRKF.org, and Kevin Gallagher is producing. Gus Weil is the guest for a while longer. Bill Kristol, the noted political commentator, a conservative, says Republicans should take President Obama's offer to raise taxes on the wealthy. And he says that this is because the GOP shouldn't fall on its sword to defend a bunch of millionaires. He points out, as we have on this show, that President Obama has become the fourth president in the last century to receive 50% of the vote, more than 50%, twice. The others are named Roosevelt, Eisenhower, and Reagan. So President Obama getting some support from the conservative camp, and you talk about a card-carrying conservative, Bill Kristol. Do you think the president will have some traction on this bid to raise taxes on the wealthy?
I hope so, and we'll know more today, because I understand he's meeting with the Republican congressional leaders and Democrat, I think, at the White House. But you take a guy like Mitch McConnell, who made the statement that the only thing he hoped to accomplish in the Senate was putting Barack Obama out of the White House. I can't see that man compromising on anything. I'm afraid that he has not learned anything. Anything. And he's obviously singing the right tune to that Republican constituency in Kentucky. So we'll have him forever.
Well, that's right. He's popular in his home state, so he can say what he wants. And I presume he's saying what he truly believes, Gus. And he's got some folks with him. And what about the Senate process in which 41 votes can tie up legislation? You don't need a majority. You need 41 to keep things from happening in the Senate because of the filibuster rules. Is that good?
It's done all the time. I don't know. It allows the minority to be extremely powerful, almost as powerful as a majority. It's from a standpoint of checks and balances, it's probably a good thing. From a standpoint of progress, it's probably not a good thing.
Pearson Cross, the political scientist you referenced a few moments ago, he predicted that Mary Landrieu will have extreme difficulty winning in 2014 with President Obama as the president. She's up in less than 2 years. She'll start campaigning, I'm sure, almost any minute for the next election. Can she win a fourth term?
It's going to be tough. Our state is now solidly Republican, so it's going to be very, very tough. And I don't know who plans to run against her.
Bill Cassidy's running against her, the congressman from Baton Rouge, by way of Chicago.
I say I did not know that. I tell you, another man who may run against and who I think shows great promise is that man who's running for the Public Service Commission from Bowbridge.
Angel?
Yes, I think he's pretty outstanding. He has a chance.
Well, if Bill Cassidy does not run, Scott Angel would be a likely candidate, and he's backed by the governor, as is Representative Cassidy. Cassidy raised a lot of money he didn't spend on his congressional election, Gus, so he's got the resources to make a run for it.
Who is that, Cassidy?
Yes.
I see. Very rare that somebody raises money and then doesn't spend it. They can always find some kind of a use,
well,
you know?
He didn't have a reason to spend it, but if he ran against Senator Landrieu, he would have ample reason to spend it.
Of course, she could come up with a tremendous amount of money, too. She's been a major representative of our own little constituency, the oil industry.
Kevin, let's go to one more cut from Governor Jindal talking about the Republican Party's future and how after five electoral defeats, now I'm talking about popular vote in the last six presidential elections, the Republican Party needs to adjust. Here's our governor.
And the way we do that is treat people with respect. We don't need to be like the Democratic Party. We don't need to divide people into special interest groups. We don't look at people as members of racial groups first or gender groups or geographic or class groups. We treat every American as an individual.
That's with Will Blitzer.
Sounds good. I don't believe he does. Can you imagine Jindal coming out for something? For example, the rights of gays. Can you imagine him embracing that?
No, but
I don't think he'll.
But people change. The president changed on that.
Yes, I don't think that. Let me put it this way: I don't think that Jindal will ever take what we would call a populist position. And if they start researching him for future races, they're not going to find where he ever said anything until right now. See, he had to redo everything. He thought that Romney might win. If Romney won, he went and spoke for him all over the country. And if Romney won, I'm sure Jindal would have gotten a cabinet position, which is no small thing. So I don't think if they research Jindal, they're not going to find where he said anything populist or anything other than far right. But now it's a new day, and he's become suddenly, he's tap dancing to the left or the middle of the spectrum. It's good politics.
I don't think he would have taken a cabinet position, Gus, even if it were offered. And there's Governor Jindal, and there's always the possibility, Kevin, always the possibility that the governor could be offered a cabinet position by President Obama.
I don't think so.
You don't?
No, I think he's too far to the right.
Don't think he'll be the next Secretary of State?
Are you kidding? You got a good sense of humor.
So do you. 297-5633 is your number. Paul in Opelousas, please be brief. Paul, you're on with Gus Weil. Hi, Paul.
How you doing, Jim? This is a question for yourself and Mr. Weil. Election's over, everything's done, hardly anything changed. See, Louisiana, governor, do you think Republican, Democrat, and who you think's going to win? Or who would be the next governor? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
You want to know who I think will be the next governor? I think that the lieutenant governor, the current man, Norton, will probably be the next governor of Louisiana. And we could do a lot worse.
Well, that is truly an eternity in politics. We're a big 3 years away from that election. And strange things can happen, Gus, as we know. For example, Mary Landrieu, she could lose next year and then run for governor the following year and get elected. You never know.
Yeah, but it's going in this state, don't look for many Democrats to be elected governor in the foreseeable future. The demographics are going to remain white, black, and whites will dominate.
Mike and Wilson. Hi, Mike. You're on with Gus.
I would just like to ask you both what you think about Harry Reid's wanting to change the filibuster in the Senate. Is there a chance of that? And would it really do any good?
I don't think that it can be changed. Sometimes I think it's a good thing, you know, because what you do is you get a handful of people to stop the course of history, of progress. But I don't think that, I think for that very reason, it probably won't change. Because when the Democrats are in the minority in the Senate, they use it. When the Republicans are in the minority in the Senate, they use it. So it's an instrument, a tool utilized by politicians of both persuasions.
Do you like Senator Reid?
I do. I think Reid is a good man. I don't think he's as strong a man as, say, Lyndon Johnson was, who was probably the best head of the Senate in my lifetime. But I think Reid is a fine man and a man whose whole life is politics and legislation. The Tea Party really went all out to defeat him, to defeat Reid. He was lucky to win.
He almost lost.
Yes.
But he won, and his state of Nevada is where Governor Jindal has celebrated victory as the chairman of the Republican Governor's Conference. And I wonder if the governor went out on the town.
I don't know. You know, I don't know him. I've been with him one time on an airplane flying back from Washington. And this was several years ago. And I found him to be a very pleasant and obviously bright young man. And he couldn't have been nicer. But I've never heard from him or seen him again.
He is a nice man, and he might be the next president, Gus.
Well, from a standpoint of the state of Louisiana, it would be a wonderful thing. But from the standpoint of what I've seen of his government, I don't think it would be a very good thing.
And you don't think that he would adjust if he were the president? He's a smart man.
I don't know if all of the constituencies whom the president serves, if they could get a seat at his table. I really don't.
Well, Gus Weil, always a delight to talk with you, and congratulations on your correct prognostications on election 2012.
Thank you, sir, and happy Thanksgiving to you and all my friends.
Thank you, Gus Weil. Bye. We're joined in studio now by two people involved with a production from Swine Palace. In fact, they've been in other places with Spill, Lee Fondakowski and Reba Wortel. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about Spill.
Spill is a play and an art installation that Reba and I are co-creating, and it's basically about the BP oil spill and the disaster that took place on board the Deepwater Horizon. And we're in development at LSU, so this is a developmental workshop that we're presenting in the community here.
Now, didn't you do something in New Orleans as well?
We did. We did another part of the lab at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, and so this is phase two of that developmental lab.
And it is based on or inspired by the BP oil disaster of 2010, and that's a story that won't go away. What's basically the focus of it?
Well, the focus has been we've talked with people across the political spectrum. We've talked with all different kinds of people along the south coast of Louisiana. So it's been important to us to just get the story and to not have an agenda per se. So we've talked with all different kinds of people that have been affected, oystermen, fishermen, shrimpers, Tea Party Republicans, environmentalists, scientists. So we have quite a diverse array of interviewees that are a part of this play and portrait series.
And Lee has been involved, as has Reva, in some other productions that have been well received, and this one is something that I think has the potential to rank with some of your outstanding work.
We'll see. We're in the process of it. I mean, the exciting thing about working on Spill, when you say, you know, what is the focus of it? We're in the process of finishing a play that is still unfolding. The drama that we're trying to capture is still unfolding. You know, yesterday it was announced BP would pay $4.5 mm-hmm. billion in fines, and two of BP's supervisors on board were charged with manslaughter. So very dramatic turns of events. I got a bunch of text messages from people yesterday saying, well, I guess you're going to have to change your ending. Uh-huh. And so we're in the process, you know, of kind of incorporating as the drama unfolds, as the trials unfold in February, that the play will be informed by how these events continue to unravel.
And you started interviewing people last year, didn't you? Early last year.
Yeah, we started interviewing people about 10 months after the spill.
March of 2011.
And each one of the interviewees posed for a portrait.
Yes. Yeah, so there's so along with the play, alongside the play, there's a collection of portraits, life-size portraits. And the idea behind that was that Lee has done this kind of work before with Laramie Project and People's Temple, and she asked me to come on board and do portraits, to paint portraits, so that not only was it a play, but there was an installation that you could go and see after the play, so that you could experience the story after the play ends. And go, and so here at Swine Palace, we across the street, there's a Foster gallery, and that's where the portraits will be on display before the play. So from 7 to 7:30, you can come and see the portraits.
And the play debuts?
The play will debut probably in the spring or the fall at American Theater Company in Chicago. So the actors that are going to be portraying the characters, the interviewees, the audience will be there listening to those stories, and then afterward can look at the images, before and after can look at the images and kind of
right.
contemplate.
So to see it here in Baton Rouge, see what you're doing right now, though,
yeah.
How do people go about doing that?
They go about doing that by, I guess, going on Swine Palace's website. And
it's free also, and it starts at 7 on Sunday and Monday evening.
That's this Sunday mm-hmm. and this Monday,
yes.
So we're close.
We're close.
And two people who have done some outstanding work, Reva Wortel, who is a great artist, and Lee Fondakowski. She mentioned your work with the Laramie Project. That one was one that was well received, wasn't it?
You know, it did become one of the most produced plays for like 10-12 years in the country. Yeah, so that was a surprise, because when we went down to Laramie, we really, well, first of all, didn't even know if we were going to write a play, but a play did come of it. We thought we would be the only company that ever performed it, but it's been performed all over the world.
What about the People's Temple?
The People's Temple was a play based on interviews with the survivors of Jonestown. So we traveled for 3 years around the country talking to those survivors, and then creating a play based on their experiences.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. We're going to take a one-minute pause, and we'll return and visit a few more minutes with Lee Fondakowski and Reva Wortel. They're involved with Swine Palace and Spill, which is recounting the dramatic story of the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon in April of 2010. And we're also going to hear from Jarell Krauss, 30 years art director for the New York Times. We'll be back after this one-minute timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And come Sunday the 18th and Monday the 19th at Swine Palace on the LSU campus, folks can see the work in progress for Spill, which recounts the story of the Deepwater Horizon tragedy and the impact on the community and marine life. And it'll take a close look at the people, the history, the culture, and the environmental crisis of coastal erosion facing southern Louisiana. Lee Fondakowski and Reva Wortel have collaborated on this. And how long have you two worked together?
This is our first time that we're working together. I had seen a collection of Reva's portraits, and They're life-size portraits, and the subjects are kind of staring straight out at the viewer. And when I saw these portraits, I thought, oh, those are very theatrical. I'd like to hear what those people have to say. And so when I decided to take on this story, in the back of my mind, I thought, I'm going to call that portrait painter and see if she will paint the people that we meet.
As far as the people you captured, Reva, how many are we talking about?
Well, at this time, there's 20 life-size portraits that I've painted, and we've been in a dialogue, Lee and I, about sometimes people come into the play, and then sometimes they get taken out based on what's relevant. And but right now, there's 20. So.
And they will be at Foster Hall.
Foster Gallery, yeah.
Across the street
from the studio theater.
Okay,
yes.
Okay, well. It should be quite a production, both visually and the stage work. Are you pleased with the way that's progressing?
I am. It was very important to us when we talk about the play's development. It will premiere and hopefully have a life across the country and around the world. But it was important to both of us to develop the work here in Louisiana so that the people who are the subjects could come, could see what we're doing, could look at their portraits, could be in dialogue with us about, are we getting the story right? How are we doing? And so that was very vital. We're grateful for Swine Palace for providing a home for us.
And once again, after you leave here, where's your next venue?
Our next venue is going to be in Chicago at American Theater Company.
In Chicago at the American Theater Company. So we're talking high cotton. Before we go to Jarell Krause from the New York Times, let's slide in Dominic in Grand Coteau, who's been waiting. Dominic, you're on the air with Reva Wortel and Lee Fondakowski. Hi, Dominic.
Good morning, everyone. The production sounds very interesting. Now, did I catch it that you said you're taking an objective approach to the incident? And if so, overall, what do y'all want the public to get out of your production?
Yes, that's an excellent question. I think for me, coming into this story, getting to know the people here, getting to know the complex environmental issues that face Louisiana, all that's incorporated into the play. But there's a cross-section of people who are telling this story, and so we're trying to let all of those points of view be in dialogue with each other. So it's really a conversation about that a community is having, and we as artists are trying to capture that conversation, the dramatic elements of that conversation, and present them on stage.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, and good luck, and we'll follow you.
All right, thank you.
Lee and Reva Wortel. Thank you. We're joined now by Jarell Krause, art director, artist, writer, 30-year tenure at the New York Times, included a record 13 years at Op-Ed, and her work is now displayed in a magnificent book, All the Art That's Fit to Print and Some That Wasn't, inside the New York Times op-ed pages. Bill Maher, who will be coming to Baton Rouge in January, says politically incorrect and hilarious to discover what really goes on inside the belly of the media beast. Read this book. Good morning, Jarell Krause.
Good morning, Jim, and thank you for quoting Bill. That was really nice. I'm glad he's going to come see you, right?
Yeah, he'll be in Baton Rouge January 27th, I believe. So
terrific.
Right
and
after.
Hey, congratulations after all the shit you guys went through.
Whoa.
I screwed up.
Well, anyway, keep
I
going.
I screwed up.
Just don't do it again.
Okay. After all you went through, that finally they coughed up a few bucks, huh, BP?
$4.5 billion, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Congratulations on that, at least.
All right.
And I'm really glad that you invited me. I'm sorry for my screw-up.
That's okay. We'll get past that. Well, tell us about spending 3 hours. Was it 3 hours in a room with Richard Nixon?
Oh, thank you. Jim, yes, he called me. You know, he wasn't my idea of a conversationalist, but he called me and he wanted me to give him the original of the drawing I'd done of him, which shocked me. I had, you know, people, it was easy to meet Reagan and Obama and Clinton and people like that, but Richard Nixon, if you are old enough to recall, was kind of a reclusive guy, especially after he left office. And so I thought, well, why not? He was probably my least favorite human being, but I decided to to bring him the original of my drawing, and it was quite an experience. He told me, "Well, come to 26 Federal Plaza." This was 9 years after he, quote, resigned, right? It was 1983. And he said, come to 26 Federal Plaza, go down the long hall, and it's the last door on your left, an unmarked door, and perform this knock.
Yeah.
So it was a, you know, I thought, oh my God, I'll be joining a cabal, you know, I'll be entering. And I did that, and we spent almost three hours together. My first words to him is that, well, we have two things in common. We're both Californians, and we're both Quakers, but I remained a pacifist. And after which he launched into a long monologue about George Fox, who's the founder of Quakerism, to prove he was really, but he really wasn't a Quaker. He couldn't have been. And you know, why you can't have pacifism in today's world.
Well, you were tough on some people who were close to Nixon, including Kissinger. Did you ever have any...
Is he one of your friends?
No, Henry and I don't hang out.
Oh, okay. Well, he lives across the park from me, but I don't hang out with him either. And where's your southern accent? I don't. Okay. David Levine did a very strong, shall we say, back portrait of him with tattooed with his war crimes, and. My editor wouldn't let me publish it, despite the fact that the article was very strong against Kissinger. But, you know, the thing is, Jim, you can say a lot. You can write a lot with prose, but to show it visually is a totally different thing. And people react much more strongly to visual images. You know, they reach the right brain.
Well, the book... All the art that's fit to print has some amazing acknowledgments from people who have been targets in the New York Times and featured in the pages of the newspaper of record in this world of ours. Mae West says, I believe in censorship. After all, I made a fortune out of it.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I don't know why the New York Times is so... afraid. The idea is they're afraid that people over the breakfast table are going to be shocked, and they would find genitalia, you know, in the weirdest places, and a thermometer in a snowstorm that they interpreted as an ejaculation. I mean, you know, the weirdest things they would see, and that was what made them. Kill pieces of art that were very innocent, but that Mae West said, thanks for quoting that.
All right, now the foreword is from Hunter Thompson. He was certainly an irreverent soul.
Yes, he was. Yes, I did hang out with him a bit, and his artist friend Ralph Steadman, yeah, he was. It was quite something.
Well, as I look at some of these illustrations, Nixon, he had to be the easiest guy in the world to caricature. He certainly was a man who drew out the best in creative types like you.
Right, that ski jump nose, and if you recall, and you may not be old enough, and he was quite something, really a very frightened, paranoid soul. He couldn't really, he wasn't able to really carry on a conversation. And as much as I sat on his floor and the carpet, and I tried to loosen him up. You know, I think I did a little bit, but he was kind of shocked at how natural I was. And he wanted to just, you know, he was kind of professorial. He was comfortable giving lectures, but not much else. He was fun to. Actually, I wasn't there yet. I was still in California then, but I didn't do. I wasn't there for the Watergate period. But that's when the New York Times started its op-ed page in 1970, which kind of prefigured the Internet's blogosphere by allowing outsiders into the Times, which was a controversy in itself, because outside writers to write for this, the newspaper record. So, I mean, I really wrote a whistleblower's book. I tell a lot of things that a lot of policy secrets and things that were never, that really were never told before. And I do this because I wanted to show another side of journalism and the Times than is published in any book. And this is actually the only book on the op-ed page, which really surprises me that nobody else did it, because it's a phenomenon, as you know, that's spread all over the world.
Well, one of the stories, anecdotes that you detail in the book is an interesting one. Hal Raines, the man who was running the newspaper, stopped the presses to kill a feature by Gary Trudeau, Doonesbury. Now, why was this?
Well, that, it's funny because Gary, I've asked about this. He says he just doesn't know. He doesn't remember why it was, but he does remember that it was a word he had in his it was a visual image, but it had some words in it. And Howell, at the last minute, after the paper, the first edition had been already distributed to Greenwich Village, he stopped the presses, and which cost millions of dollars, because he objected to one word, which Gary doesn't even remember what the word was. But he was so upset to see this word that he forced the Times to spend all that money just to get it out of the paper.
Well, the book is from Jerrell Krauss, 30 years. She was art director at the New York Times, working for the op-ed page, which began, hard to believe, it's only been 42 years, September 21st, 1970. And the book is complete with work done from then to now. And we thank you for your time and your
thank you. And if your listeners are interested, they can get it on Amazon for 30% off. And it's a really great gift book. I'll never make a penny, so I just want people to get the word out. And thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you, Jerrell. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye. And we're joined in studio in our remaining time as we round out the week with some more literate people. Good morning, Dr. Adelaide Russo.
Good morning, Jim.
Get a little closer. And Adelaide is here to talk about some folks who are in this great town of ours from Mauritius.
Mauritius. The comparative literature program at LSU has a series of lectures and events that are in conjunction with an organization called the Association of Literary Scholars, Critics, and Writers. And we're perfectly delighted this afternoon to have at 3 a.m. in Dodson Auditorium.
I think it's 3 p.m.
3 p.m., not 3 a.m.
Don't show up at 3 a.m. at Dodson Auditorium in the quadrangle. You might be alone.
3 p.m. in Dodson Auditorium. We're having two writers, one who's actually from Baton Rouge, Olivia Clare, who is a young poet who has just won the Lilly Prize for Emerging Poets, and our visitor from far away is named Barlin Piamato. He was invited by the American ambassador to participate in a program for international writers at the University of Iowa's famous Writers' Workshop, and he's also doing a residency at the University of Pittsburgh. He is an editor.
Well, let's give him a chance to talk. Barlin Piamato, who hails from Mauritius, right?
Yeah.
Well, tell us why you're in Baton Rouge and what you'll be talking about at 3 o'clock this afternoon at Dodson Auditorium on the campus of Louisiana State University, less than 24 hours before LSU tees it up against the Ole Miss Rebels. Barlin?
Oh, I'll first listen to the poems of Clara, and I'll talk about my three novels I've written. And It's crazy because I've been invited by American embassy and I'm writing French. I'm publishing in France, so I'm very grateful to the U.S. Department and to be here, to have seen Iowa and to be in Pittsburgh, in Baton Rouge. So
how does one get from Mauritius to Baton Rouge?
You can go to Paris first. It's 11 hours by flight.
And 11 then, hours?
Yeah. And then you go to Detroit, for example, and then to Iowa, and from Iowa you go to Washington and New York, and then go back to Pittsburgh, and then come to Atlanta, and then Baton Rouge. So it's a long trip.
So you've been making the tour, and you've seen a few of the great cities in our country.
Yeah.
What do you think of Baton Rouge?
I went to New Orleans 2 months ago for a mid-trip travel, and you know, politically, Mauritius is in Africa, even if it's in the Indian Ocean. But when I went to New Orleans, because of the history of the social structure of the architecture, I found that Mauritius is close to Louisiana, much more closer than to Africa. So I'm very delighted to come back to Louisiana.
Well, our guest, Barlin Piamatu, will be at Dodson Hall this afternoon, 3 o'clock, and it's in the Quadrangle. And as we part company, Olivia, do you have a few words, very briefly? You'll be there as well.
Yes, I'll be reading my poems, and I'm really happy to be back in Baton Rouge. I grew up in Baton Rouge, and then I went away for college and graduate school,
and
so happy to be back.
Congratulate you on your success, Olivia Clare. Thank you, Adelaide Russo, as well. And we'll be back Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.